Welcome back to The Continent of Resistance, a podcast on labor movements across Asia, and our special series on the striking decade.
So this is the last episode in this special series on the 2010s decade of worker struggle in Asia. I want to see if we can offer some kind of explanations or to the, some of the original questions that motivate us to do this series. So maybe we can want to begin with asking you, Kyung, what are some of your takeaways? Do you feel in your mind the some of the questions that you had in mind have been answered, or there's some interesting, useful explanations?
Hi, Kevin. Yeah, that's a big, tough question. I mean, definitely we've gained some insight into the cycle of strikes in the countries that we look at. I would say that, you know, I would say that these processes are pretty much historical, right? We, you know, wouldn't be able to understand why it happened without looking at a longer term perspective, without looking at this historical perspective. And that is to say geographical and historical too, right? We can't just pick one event and like say, oh, this is what happened and generalize it. It's impossible. And to understand what happened in the context, we have to put that into perspective, geographical and historical. And I just want to add that what we are trying to do, we are not trying to categorize the countries at all, right? We are not picking one country or two countries and say, oh, this is, you know, they belong to this group of countries, and you know, if this happened, that would follow. That is not our intention. But I think the benefit of doing this is, from my perspective, I think we complement some of the analysis that we see being done by scholars, you know, for example, who look at regime types, and we want to complement that kind of analysis from you know, by looking at what happened on the ground, by looking at internal dynamics, by looking at what workers decided and their limitation and their and their viewpoint or standpoint. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just one thing. What about you?
Yeah, I think I like what you said about the historical geographic perspective, and we can also add to that, obviously, the comparative perspective that underlies our analysis and our series. I think those are, like, to me, really important dimensions of our analysis that sometimes get sort of sidelined, because we do tend to, for good reasons, we do tend to focus on what's happening right now or what's happening in the very recent past, like the last few months or last year. So to take a historical, geographic, but also comparative perspective, it gets us to think more critically and in a more nuanced way. Some of the specific events maybe that happen in specific locations, specific countries, or specific time and really situate that in a longer perspective and more comparative perspective. And that's been really helpful for me to clarify some of the things that we want to discuss.
Yeah, I think what it means for practitioners, what it means for us, for people who are working on the daily basis with the labor movement, is, you know, we wanted to change things in a radical way, right? But I think by having this kind of perspective, I think we know that there are things that we cannot change right away, especially for example, in order to coordinate a general strike at that scale, there's you know, a lot of work, you know, involved in terms of building up the movement, or it does a process of, you know, working towards something. So I think, yeah, for me, the kind of concrete things that I learned from this is to build workers' power, you know, We learned that there is some kind of contradiction or dialectic in that process as well, right? Like, you know, the law, labor laws that we sorted from process of industrialization, it opened up some space, but also restrict or restrained, you know, our capabilities. And there's that kind of feedback loop. We need to understand, you know, that things are not black and white, and we can take this lesson and apply it into our work in understanding. Sometimes, even with our limitation, we could see it as a result of, you know, multiple numerous factors, and understand it in the, you know, in the way that doesn't really weigh on us always. You know, doesn't, like, what I mean to say is just to not say that, oh, you know, we can't do that because we are not capable, but, you know, there are some structural factors, and we could also build our power and aim toward a bigger movement if we work on it and understand the process that happened in the past. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that this is something I have been thinking a lot in the last actually few years now, is to look back at the past, the recent past, and really understand and analyze and understand some of the lessons, because I think very often there's a sense of, oh, you know, that's all, you know, for social movement to say, oh, it's all in the past, now we need to focus on what's happening right now. So there's kind of what people call presentism. It's always like, what's happening now, what's happening now. And, you know, especially if there people feel there is a defeat or there's a lack of successes
right.
in previous struggles, people are just like, okay, that didn't work. But I think, you know, it's not always clear. Certainly I felt it was not always clear why something didn't work or why something worked. And I think people tend to offer very ad hoc kind of explanations. They could be because this happened or because, you know, that. So I think what we did in this whole series was to look at the whole period in kind of comparative perspective also, because that's to say, well, the strike wave that happened in so many countries didn't just happen because of local dynamics. There's that global
right.
dynamics as well.
Right.
At the same time, if they didn't advance certain or they didn't secure more power, it may or may not only due to local dynamics either, right? There's global context or regional context that may explain some of the reasons both for successes or its failures. So I think that's really helpful to get us out of that kind of national sort of methodological nationalism that tend to underlie a lot of analysis.
Yeah, talking about analysis, I think one of the things that frustrate me for some time now, and this is actually what's commonplace too, I mean, for the analysis of labor movement, usually most of the analysis talked about, you know, like when we ask the question about why our movement or why a certain movement is weak or not strong, there, you know, there's a lot of analysis out there that only explains part of the story. They always talked about laws, they always talked about, you know, what the governments or what the employers do, and what is lacking is what's happening inside the movement, right? And I think that goes to the idea of structure and agency, like how much we're conditioned into this and how much we take, you know, our agency into our own hand and you know, try to own the future. And I think by looking at this in the strike wave in this way, I think it kind of gives me some ideas or insight into how, you know, how much things are, the extent to which things are conditions, but we also have a lot of room to make things happen, to own the future,
right.
to change,
right.
which, yeah, that's analysis, that part of the analysis, I think I was trying to add into this, into our special series, you know, but for better or worse, I think we are able to achieve that to a certain limit, right?
And I think the other maybe takeaway for me is, you know, at the toward the end of this series, we, you know, we spoke about the you know, the crisis of social production, you know, the need to focus on more on obviously platform workers, but also care workers and other categories of workers who are not traditionally like factory workers, right? I think very often in your conversations, there's still a sense that you're only a worker if you're working in factory, but that's certainly, you know, not the case anymore. There are more and more workers are working service sectors in sectors that to do with social production. And so I guess my takeaway from that is also think that maybe that specific type of struggle, you know, centered in factories, you know, led mostly by factory industrial workers, that may be specific to a period of industrialization, right? And now we have other type of workers in other industries also organizing. Maybe the way they organize may be different, or the kind of struggle they conduct may not be just a simple repetition of what happened before. I think that's another lesson that it's not that we should not simply expect things just to repeat, that things may take in different in new directions.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a really good point to think about how workers in different sectors or in different types of work could wield power, to think about where they work, to think about the what workplace for them look like, and how they could organize, around the conditions that they have, right? So I think it's a question to point to the future, in terms of where we are headed to. And I remember we talked about this in the first season, where we see a lot of disconnects, right? Disconnects between the traditional trade union movements in many countries, and where the workers are right now. It's a lot of them are, outside of the confine of what trade unions see themselves as relevant to, or of the industrial relation framework. But that is where the power is. If we are going to organize them, or going to bring that power into the movements, and that's a lot of questions to that we need to answer.
Yeah, I think those are like I think really key questions. I think the on the one hand, you know, the discussions about China, Vietnam offers an example where how, you know, where workers struggled and are, you know, managed to organize resistance without any form of union involvement. At the same time, you know, you have, you know, in certainly in Indonesia, we saw so many new unions, independent unions emerging in the last couple of decades after democratization. But that also poses other kind of questions in terms of fragmentation. But also, I think just in general, workers are, especially workers in non-industrial sectors, they either are not in the union, or if they are, or others may even not want to be part of a union. That's been some experiences with some platform workers in different places. So what kind of union organizations, what form of worker organizations should we develop, or how should we think about union to union in kind of less bureaucratic and maybe centralized way? Yeah, I think those are questions we don't have answer for, obviously, in this series, but I think we don't want to pose those questions.
Yeah, another thing I think I learned from this is to, well, it's one thing to talk about it in an abstract, and it's another to be able to see how it unfolded. Is I think it's the diversity of players in terms of coordinating general strike or labor activism in the Asian context. I think it, for example, the case of Indonesia just shows me demonstrated that there were a lot of types of organization involved, right? And like not only NGOs, not only trade unions, but there are also NGOs, and even within the labor movements, there are many layers and scales of organization involved. And the key takeaway from from the Indonesian history at the time that we look at was the importance of having grassroots organizations alongside the national movements. I think that is one takeaway that I see, that we really need to cultivate the grassroots, you know, organizing on the ground and try to build a network between the grassroots mobilization and national coordinations. I think that's key. And also, I think from what you said earlier, it's the idea of thinking about to go beyond the binary of labor and non-labor, to go beyond the binary of labor and community, or labor movement and social movement. I think it is more productive now to think in terms of workplace and non-workplace issues, rather than separate labor from the social movement, or thinking about labor separate from the communities. Because, you know, like in the case of Indonesia and how they built the national movement, the strike movement was to kind of just go to show how much workers, how important the communities were for the worker, you know, that they built power around the community rather than only the workplace.
I also want to talk a little bit about what are some of the, maybe what are the limitations, what we have done, or maybe put it another way, other question that we are still unclear about, you know, we have not managed to really shed much light on, or it's kind of beyond our understanding right now. Other things that I think we should keep exploring.
For me, one thing is to, I think one thing that we could, you know, we could go deeper, and I wish we have more to say, is to kind of to tackle the idea of spontaneous wildcat strikes in a lot of places. I think for me, we probably, because we don't have enough information, right, that explains what happened before or what happened behind the wildcat strike that we look at. And I think this is maybe this is one of the biggest, I don't know, weakest link that I saw from people analyzing wildcat strikes. Yeah. What about you?
Yeah, I think I should say that, you know, we chose for or selected four countries. We could have chosen other countries that offer maybe a different example or counterexample. So I think we should, you know, acknowledge our limited, you know, coverage, that we don't mean this to be somehow representative of everything that was happening in Asia in that decade. And there are other countries that had, you know, that seen very different things than what we're seeing in those four countries. So I think that's kind of, maybe for me, this is a starting point to explore this decade or this period of 30, 40 years of worker struggle. But for me, I will be interested to explore more about other places. For example, I spoke with friends who follows labor, worker struggle, labor movement in India. And the dynamics is also quite interesting, quite different from maybe some of the East Asian and Southeast Asian countries. But there was also kind of a strike wave that took place a bit later, I think around 2015, 2016. A bit later than the period that we were looking at, which in the four countries we are looking at were closer to 2010. But either way, I feel like there may be a larger processes or larger kind of dynamic at play that you know, cut across so many different like countries, regions, sub-regions, and also different regime types. So for me, it'd be sort of interesting to think more, even more comparatively. But I think what we have done is kind of a good starting point.
Right. Yeah, I think I know what you mean. For example, an example of Indians strike. I saw some of the interesting analysis that point to contradiction of, you know, having large or mass mobilization, but weaker and weaker movements. For example, from India, right? That's one interesting context that is different from what we looked at. Yeah, I think it's we. I think we could also. Yeah, we could go on and on and find various examples of, you know, different things that happen. Yeah, but it's definitely a good starting point for us to start thinking about this. Yeah. Or we can even, you know, expand our timeline to cover more than one or two decades, right? To think about maybe 50 years or 100 years of struggle. I mean, if we have a really good documentation, like in the US, you know, people are looking at now, they're comparing the labor movement now with the like strike in the 20th century, and I think that probably will give us a really interesting picture of what we are.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. I think this is just, you know, looking at history is never just about getting stuck in the past, right? We're looking at history so that they can help inform us or analysis or movement building today. And you know, the other aspect of this is of course revisiting some of the organizing strategies and traditions of early periods, sometimes that they just got forgotten, even though, you know, I don't think anyone would suggest that we can just copy and paste, you know, organizing strategy from 50 years ago, 100 years ago. But I do think there's something to the idea of that we, some of the fundamental questions of worker struggles are broadly similar across time and space, even though specific conditions or specific institutions are
right.
That we're dealing with may be different. But I think a lot of the fundamental questions about how do you build workers' power against, you know, very hostile employers and also a hostile government, I think those sort of thinking through how do you organize workers and build workers' power in those contexts, I think kind of universal. I think that's why, you know, in the US and I think maybe in other places as well, people look back to revisit some of the same questions and to look at how people in the past, organizers and activists in the past, have sort of grappled with those questions. I think that this will be interesting. Maybe that's something we can do going forward. It's going even back and look at some of the organizing traditions, right, of early periods and what can they tell or say about us today.
That's really nicely put.
Want to thank all the listeners, and yeah, it's been a long journey to get this series produced with you, Kian, and I appreciate all the work that you have put into this, and many many hours of recording.
And I would love to hear feedback on how we do it in the special series to in order to improve for the future. I'm asking our listener to, yeah, please give us some feedback if you like what we're doing here. Also, you know, or if we don't, you see any improvements or any things that we could do better, feel free to reach out. Yeah, thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Continent of Resistance podcast and our series on the striking decade. I hope you enjoy the conversation, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast.